This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December the 22nd, 2014. This audio recording is presented by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Any use of the audio from this presentation without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. This audio is copyright 2014 Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Let's take a look at what has happened in the past week in federal taxes. One big thing that happened this week is it became final. We now have the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014 is now law. The Senate passed the bill this week just before they left town, and on Friday the President signed the bill into law. Thus, all of the items we talked about the last 2 weeks, the extenders plus the new provisions we talked about last week, have now become part of the law. So those items can be used for this year's tax planning in the limited time we have available. And we can also begin planning for those issues like the ABLE accounts and the certified professional employer organization issues that will take place in the future. So you want to be sure if you've been watching for this, it is now official. That bill is now law. Next up, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals approved the tax court's decision in the Belk versus Commissioner case. This case, which went back a few years ago, which went back to 2012, which was the reference there as to 140 TC number 1. This week in docket number 13-2161 at the Fourth Circuit, tax notes today reference 2014 TNT 242-11. The court was looking at, and the tax court had looked at, and the Fourth Circuit agreed about whether a right to substitute land managed to kill a conservation easement deduction for federal tax purposes. In essence, could you allow, and in this case what they allowed for was, that the easement could be, the land could be substituted. If the charity and the donor agreed, they could substitute a different piece of land in the future for the piece of land that was originally part of the donation, if it was comparable land, comparable value, etc. The taxpayer argued effectively, well, that was no harm, no foul, also argued that there was a savings clause anyway that said that if it violated the rules, that in essence they would not be able to use that provision. The tax court found first that you could not substitute. A substitution provision in a qualified conservation easement will serve to effectively make it not a qualified conservation easement. The Fourth Circuit noted that the law talks about the piece of real estate must be have a permanent restriction upon it. The court made an issue about the fact that that indicates that it's got to be the one you start with and not other real estate down the line. The Fourth Circuit also sustained the tax court view that the savings clause, in essence, failed to meet the qualifications required. If you're going to try to have a savings clause, the savings clause is something that says, well, we're going to have this clause in the gift, but if it turns out that clause would cause us to lose a benefit, then that clause would be void. The tax court had stated that didn't work. The Fourth Circuit agreed with that ruling, noted that if they were to apply the savings clause as the taxpayer suggests, that would be providing an opinion sanctioning the very same trifling with the judicial process that they condemned, that is the Fourth Circuit, in the Proctor case, which is one of our best-known cases about when a savings clause does not work. That was for estate tax purposes. The same basic rule applies here for income tax purposes. Next, we're going to consider a case from the tax court this week, 2014-253, TC Memo 2014-253, that is Price versus Commissioner. The taxpayer in this case had a money-losing business breeding half-Arabian horses. Now, this thing had been losing money for a long time. In fact, it lost money from 1993 all the way through 2012, which was the last year we had information of on in the case. So the taxpayer, looking at that and figuring, by the way, the court did decide this too, that this thing was going to lose on the Section 183 rules for hobby loss standing alone, said, oh, no, no, no. This business supports my car dealership, which is where I make all my money, right? Many of our clients who go ahead and establish these kind of side horse businesses always are doing so with money that comes from their profitable business. Now, the taxpayer said, on my case, though, there was a case back in 2007, the Topping case, where an interior designer had gotten 90% of her clients came from contacts that she had in her equestrian riding business. And the taxpayer in this case claimed, well, I'm just like the taxpayer in Topping. Unfortunately, the tax court pointed out that a ridiculously small, even if we accepted all of what they claim to be horse people sales for the car dealerships, they were far less than 1% of the sales for the dealership for the year in question. Secondly, the court noted that many of these sales that the taxpayer identified as horse person sales turned out on further analysis to clearly not be horse person sales. It turned out they were things they pulled together for trial to try to make this position, which the court also pretty clearly indicated that they weren't really tracking horse person sales, so they weren't running the horse activity as something to generate sales and only operating it because it paid for itself with the car dealership. It didn't. The court found it was highly distinguishable. The court also found that a lot of this information they tried to use to support their position that these were integrated was only developed after they became aware the IRS was going to examine the horse issue, the horse operation, and then they tried to somehow claim it was part of the car dealership. All of those things caused the case to fall apart. This case is distinguishable, and it's important in this case probably to note I know that sometimes we go back and we research and we find something like the Topping case and say, we can use that in our situation. Be careful how far you push it. Topping did not say that as long as you have some tie-in with the business in some way, shape, or form, that you can have this money-losing operation and do it however you want. The case makes very clear, and this case does, that facts matter. Topping was a very fact-specific case, and the fact that the overwhelming amount of her business came from that course-related business was what saved it in Topping. That was clearly not the case in Price. Well, a entity or a plaintiff that thought they were doing well in court turns out now to find out that they now have lost two separate cases. This is the case of the Freedom from Religion Foundation versus Costigan, in this case 2014 TNT 242-10. This one comes from the same Wisconsin District Court that had ruled in favor of the Freedom from Religion Foundation when in a previous challenge they had challenged the minister's housing allowance. Now you may remember just recently the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Freedom from Religion Foundation had no standing to challenge the minister's housing allowance exclusion because they themselves had not asked to have that excluded from their income. Now, this particular case was a different issue they were pushing up. They were arguing that churches being exempted from filing Form 990s served as an impermissible violation of the U.S. Constitution, violating both the Establishment Clause and the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Previously, the district court had found they had standing to continue here, but following the Seventh Circuit case, the court went back and reanalyzed that position. The court found, like as in the case with the minister's housing allowance, they had not asked for this particular waiver. They hadn't asked for their own tax-exempt organization's right to be excluded from filing Form 990. Having not asked for that right, they had no damages with which to claim. Now realize, as the court makes very clear, this organization was not asking for all tax exempts to be exempt from filing 990. They were asking for churches to be required to file 990, which is a different issue they have in front of them. So they hadn't asked for an exemption. Frankly, they don't want an exemption. Well, the court said, okay, they hadn't asked for one, but there was a second possibility that they brought up. The penalties for failing to file a Form 990 are rather nasty on the charitable organization. So the charity argued that, well, we really couldn't refuse to file a 990 because if we had, the penalties would be horrid. It turns out the court decided that might give you justification, but in this particular case, the organization had no intent to ever go out and look for an exemption. In fact, they said they were not planning to file an exemption. Therefore, the court found that they had not been intimidated into failing to file a 990, and for that reason, they still lack standing. We're back to the same problem we were with the original case. For this organization to move forward, they must go and ask for the very benefit that they don't really want, but they need to ask for that benefit and be denied it to have standing to go to court and claim damages because they had to file a 990 or they had to include their housing allowance and wages. We'll see if this organization decides to take the bait and go down that road. Even better, we're going to see if the IRS decides to grant their request for waivers in this case, which would also serve to cause them to be unable to move forward with their cases in court that they wish to move forward with. In any event, it's an interesting case to keep your eye on. Next up, we have the case of United States versus Coleman. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal here was looking at an appeal from a district court case that ruled that, in fact, a taxpayer who had asked for a collection due process hearing, right? We're looking here at the collection statute. Remember that 10-year statute the IRS has to collect a liability. That statute is told during the period for which you ask for collection due process hearing, the period that hearing is running, and the pendency of any appeals of that decision when it comes out. A taxpayer has 30 days after a final decision in the collection due process hearing to file a petition in the tax court to review that decision. In this particular case, the taxpayer did not file for such a review. When the taxpayer fails to file for that review, now the question comes up. Does that 30-day period count? And that was important in this case because the IRS filed their action against the taxpayer to collect the tax right towards the end of the period. The taxpayer, the IRS's filing occurred after its statute would have closed if that 30-day period did not count, but within the statute if that 30-day period did count. The district court had ruled, because the IRS regulations state, that in fact, once you ask for a CDP hearing, the statute will not close until, you know, basically the tolling period does not stop until that 30-day period that you had to file a tax court petition ends, regardless of whether you file for the petition or not. The Ninth Circuit noted that, in fact, the code is on that issue, doesn't state that directly. Rather, the code suggests that basically, you know, it tells, as I mentioned, during the CDP and the pendency of any appeals. The court found that that did not mean if you did not file a tax court petition. The code clearly stated that since you never asked for a tax court appeal, we went back to just the case and lost the 30 days. Rather, the court found that statute is ambiguous. Finding an ambiguity, the Ninth Circuit went and applied the standard that we had in the Mayo Foundation case, which applied the Chevron standard from an older case, the Chevron standard. The Mayo Foundation case, which was from the Supreme Court a couple years ago, told us how to work with these regs in the tax area. Generally, under the Mayo Foundation standard, if a code section is ambiguous, therefore it is subject to multiple readings, and the IRS has issued regulations on the topic, so long as those regulations represent a reasonable construction of the statute, the IRS interpretation is the only interpretation that a taxpayer is allowed to use. The Ninth Circuit then went and looked at this case. It found that, in fact, going back a ways, the Eighth Circuit had, in a previous case, taking a look at the language under Section 7609E in the case of United States versus Meyer, found that with statute language that was very similar under that section, the IRS regulation that included the time period during which you could file an appeal in the tax court counted toward tolling the statute was found to be reasonable. Having found that to be true, the Ninth Circuit found that the same construction, this time looking at a construction under Section 6502A1 and the tolling statute that we found here with regard to the statute of limitations, under 6330E1, that is also clearly a reasonable interpretation of the statute. Therefore, the court found the IRS had started its procedures to collect the tax filed timely in court, and therefore the district court was correct by allowing the case to move forward. Finally, Revenue Procedure 2014-63 came out, and in that revenue procedure, the IRS consolidated the guidance on mediation programs into a single ruling. Previously, the IRS had issued Revenue Procedure 2009-44 to govern mediation procedures, but following that, they expanded these procedures into various payroll tax issues and offer and compromise issues, so trust fund recovery penalties and offer and compromise via announcements 2011-6 and 2008-111, and also established what were pilot programs in those cases where only certain cities had the right to use the mediation process. Now the IRS has decided to make those processes that previously were just selected cities available to all taxpayers, and they've consolidated all the guidance now into this new ruling. Revenue Procedure 2014-63 provides all of that in one place and generally has some minor modifications. It clarifies that whipsaw issues include issues on a joint return where both spouses do not agree to participate in the same mediation proceeding or where a spouse is claiming innocent spouse treatment under Section 6015. Those are cases where this will not apply. It also, as we said, expands offer and compromise and trust fund recovery penalty cases beyond the selected cities that they previously were limited to. It creates a number of modifications to make this work, basically for those new cases in the offering compromise and trust and recovery penalty area. The key takeaway from this is now every taxpayer has a right to ask for the mediation process in an offering compromise and trust fund recovery penalty cases, so long as those cases meet the other requirements for mediation. Finally, Field Attorney Advice 2014-500-50-01F, that's 2014-5001F, the IRS concluded, not surprisingly, that the TEFRA Consolidated Partnership Examination Procedures do not apply in a payroll tax case. Apparently, the issue had become a concern. Do employment tax examiners who are examining employment tax issues or worker classification issues have to follow the TEFRA Consolidated Audit Procedures if they're auditing the payroll issues with a partnership that is otherwise subject to the TEFRA Consolidated Audit Procedures? The advice concludes that, in fact, TEFRA is limited to items under Subtitle A of the Internal Revenue Code. Those are the only partnership items covered by the TEFRA Consolidated Audit Procedures. Payroll tax issues and worker classification issues come under Subchapter C of the Internal Revenue Code. Therefore, they do not affect partnership items that are subject to the TEFRA procedures. So for that reason, the IRS does not need to follow the TEFRA procedures in this case, in fact, cannot be used those procedures, and must instead use traditional procedures. That's not a real big issue in this case because, of course, in this case, the actual tax will be paid by the partnership anyway if there is a tax shortfall discovered. Therefore, these procedures would not really make sense in this case. The field attorney advice just makes it very clear that agents should not be using those procedures in this case. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments Review for the week of December 22nd, 2014. Go ahead and join us next week as we go ahead and get ready to close out 2014, looking at the developments, which probably won't be huge during the upcoming holiday week. And we'll talk about what it looks like going forward into 2015.